Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Are you ready to take your screenwriting career to the next level? If you're a new or aspiring screenwriter who feels lost or stuck in your career, the Working Writer School is here to teach you what writing courses don't.
Former student Dylan Evans said, "There are a ton of writing classes out there, but this course helped me work through the stuff that I couldn't find anywhere else. I feel more prepared and more knowledgeable to take on the next phase of my writing career."
Writer Nicole Bennett said, "After taking this course, I have a clear framework for the mindset, productivity, networking, and financial management skills needed for longevity in this industry."
And Jay Burlingham calls this course the map. "This course has given me a map that I will return to again and again as I move forward in my career as a writer."
Use code MMIH for 10% off from now until January 31st and go to theworkingwriter.com. That's theworking, W-E-R-K-I-N-G, writer.com to sign up today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out right now. Watch it on all the places you can watch digital movies. Buy it on Amazon on a DVD.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. Currently in development on one more, which is Best Friends Forever. It's my horror feature, and we're going to make it next year. I'm also a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome producer-director Mark Pellington on the show to talk about the re-edit of his first feature, Going All the Way. Ulrich talks with him about why he re-edited the film 25 years later. We talk with him about directing music videos and what it was like to work on a Quibi show. We then play another round of The Game. But first, Ulrich, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. You know, hanging in there. You know, we're rocking and rolling on this feature still. I mean, we got another, wasn't really a past, more like unavailable sort of situation. And now my EP is like tired of this, of getting like, you know, no's. And so now he's just going to go with the route he knows. So we're switching up gears and we're going to go with some of these other casts that he's worked with before. People more in their realm, you know, more of the B-level people. B-level is what he calls them, but they're really, I don't know, depending on how you use the level system, right? It's probably more like a C or D level.
Sure.
You know, compare, like, especially, I don't, was it Colin Stryker? I think he was calling... Yeah. B-level was like, I don't know, what, Bruce Willis or something. I don't know what he was using for it. He was like, oh, yeah, not quite Brad Pitt, but right below Brad Pitt. But I think a lot of times people use B-list as like B-movie actors. Like, you know, who's a B-movie actor? Michael Madsen.
Yeah, we talk about it every week. We have like a cadre of five that we reference.
Yeah.
It's the one who was in, actually, he was just listed as... in the most amount of movies, I think.
Eric Roberts?
Yes, Eric Roberts.
I think he is in the most amount of movies because he just says yes to everything because he loves to work.
Yeah.
And he'll do your movies. If you want to make a movie, you can make it with Eric Roberts. He'll make it happen for you, which is a beautiful thing. And it's so crazy that like he has done this for years, decades of being in any movie, and he still gets choice roles in big stuff because he's just that good. It has not hurt him, you know? Anyways, so yeah, we're doing that. That's cool. It's going to be fun. I don't know what it's going to mean. If it's going to be like, oh yeah, we're going to start making this movie in first quarter 2022 or 2023. Dear God. But maybe. I think that's what everyone thinks. I don't know what I think. I hope we make it in the first quarter.
I feel like it's always add like happen. 6 months to whatever someone says out loud. You know, it's like whatever the anticipated date is, like in your mind, add 6 months and it'll make you feel a little bit better if there's a delay.
Seems about right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, if we got that, that would be, if we made it in 6 months, that would be incredible. If we made it in 2023 at all, that would be incredible. I kind of feel like making any movie at all ever is incredible. So, you know, I'm pretty excited about that. You know, I'm really deep in the shit right now with conforming. It's not conforming. It's online editing, but like, so basically I thought I was conforming the movie, but we're actually hiring a really good studio to conform it, which is like,
oh,
whew, thank goodness gracious me. That is awesome. So I don't have to have that stress on my shoulders, but I still have to get them all the stuff. And since they're a fancy pantsy studio, their turnover specs are like fucking bullshit. I mean, it's like, oh yeah, every time there's a reposition, you have to make a mark in Premiere. Every time there's a keyframe, make a mark. Every time there's this, so it's like I'm just going through this thing and marking everything. And then like I have to, like we have all these blended shots where they took two shots together and then they like, you did this weird blendy effect. Mm-hmm. So like every time that happens, I have to make the blend myself and provide a comp. So I'm basically like becoming a visual effects artist as well. So I was like trying to do that last night and like I stayed up like super late trying to figure out this blended thing. And I did like 12 of them and then 9 of them worked and 3 didn't. And I was like, you know what? This is crazy. And there's probably like 50 to 60 of these things. So what we decided was like, forget the blend shots for now. Just deliver them everything else so they can start working on it. And then I can work on the blend shots over like the next week or so. But man, this online editing thing is hard. It's not easy. I don't think anyone ever said it was easy, but it certainly isn't. But it's fun. I like being part of a movie. It's cool to like see it happening behind the scenes and like see like the process that XYZ goes through for film festivals and the way they work with their filmmakers. Like I kind of get like a little peek into that world a little bit, which is fun. It's also just like crazy just to think about like, you know, all these movies, like they're like doing the same process as me or you or anybody who's trying to get a movie into a film festival. It's just at different levels, right? Like they have a little bit more influence. They have a little bit more connection, you know, but like the outcome is if they don't get into those film festivals, they're going to come and be in the same boat as us, you know, but then they spent like, you know, whatever, 10 times amount on their movies, you know.
I mean, XYZ, if you're talking about XYZ as a distributor, informing what kind of placement their titles get on these platforms is a little bit different than a smaller distributor or
that's probably an true. I guess I was just thinking of our good friend Tom Schulman from last week we interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and his movie, you know, it premiered at Newport and then it played Dances with Films. And, you know, they don't have XYZ behind them, so that's very different. But, you know, still, like, whatever, millions of dollars of budget, and it's in the same pool as The Alternate, you know? And it's just like, it's kind of crazy.
But again, if their sales rep can negotiate better terms, it is not in the same bracket as us. We don't know who his sales agent is. I think that was something that surprised me, where like when I worked at Sundance, we had a, you know, like a bat phone to the guy who curated the front page of iTunes when that was a very big deal. And like my boss would just call him up and be like, hey, will you take a look at this movie and see whether you want to promote it extra? You know what I mean? Like there's so many handshake deals that we don't have, that we're not even aware of. So I always like to assume the opposite that you assume, because you are the optimist and I am the pessimist. And I always assume that there's more going on behind closed doors than I have access to.
Yeah. But I mean, like, do you think that a movie that like, you know, plays like, okay, so with a sales rep who's great and a sales rep who is maybe non-existent because you don't have one, or is just average, but they play the same festivals, same kind of level of talent, no names or anything. Do you think the one sales agent can sell the movie way better than the other, even though it's got the same stuff?
Because festivals don't really matter at a certain point. Yeah, absolutely.
It's
about relationships that sales rep has. I mean, this is something that I'm going through right now on Twitter. Like I posted about on Twitter and like there's like 300 likes on it right now. And it kind of took off in a weird way. But I rep a wonderful micro-budget action comedy. It is a wonderful film. No festivals. No festivals whatsoever. No name cast. I pitch it. I knew who to pitch it to, and I pitch it to the right party. I got a really solid distributor, you know, not like a name distribution company, but one that's not a catalog distributor. And then I got two international offers myself, just me, just little old Liz. And it's like, this is a film that hasn't played festivals. So I know it's, you know, it's a genre film, but it's not, it hasn't taken off in any way. So a good sales rep can make a meaningful difference for your film. Absolutely.
Right. Are you talking about like where they got an MG for their movie and everything? Or are you just talking about getting it like with a distributor who's going to take it out and do the same thing that everybody else is doing?
Well, I mean, we can get into my philosophy on MGs, but I really don't think MGs are shorthand for a good deal. I think MGs are manipulative in that very often filmmakers are told to only take deals with upfront money when sometimes that's the only amount of money you're going to see. So this deal, we're electing not to push for an MG, and we're going to negotiate the terms. And you know, we looked into the references, not the provided references from the distributor, but we found other people to vouch for the distributor. And I got two references for him from the distribution side of things, other distributors who said, this guy is great. You should go with him. So like for me, I feel it's just so wonderful to find a pathway for a micro budget film with no cast, because it feels like there's no hope for a lot of us, you know?
Yeah. I guess just from my perspective, it's like when you're on the other side of it, like, you know, and you've gone through the process and, you know, you went with that same exact thing that you said, recommended distributor, really nice person, good credits, lots of great ideas, lots of great plans. And then like in the end, you know, you don't end up getting any of the deals that you're hoping to get. You don't get, you know, a streaming deal. You don't get a cable deal. You don't get this deal, like all these things.
Well, most films don't get those things. It's about the optics of what it of like, because you don't have to you don't have to tell everyone you didn't get those deals. It's about the optics of the story you're choosing to tell, right? But in terms of sustainability, and we talk about this all the time, and I'm a broken record, so I'm sorry for anyone who gets bored by this, but like, no, filmmakers are not making money because those deals aren't ever present for a lot of us. So for you, for anyone to be disappointed by a distributor who doesn't secure them licensing opportunities, that's like the story I hear from every filmmaker every single day. But I would say very few films that are my that are similar to my clients with no festival and no cast and kind of a squishy genre can get to a distributor that only takes like a handful of films a year. You know what I mean? So it's about how that sales rep can jump the line to those opportunities. But I'm with you, Ulrich. It sucks. It sucks. Even if you do all your research, it sucks. I'm with you 100%.
It just feels like, you know, unless you get this like golden ticket, whether that be a sales rep who has all the connections or whatever it is. Like I heard this story. I don't even have told this story before, but I heard this story from somebody about them like having this movie. It's like a $750,000 movie or something. They didn't play any good festivals. They got rejected by like all the good distribution companies and everything. Then they were friends with somebody like who was friends with Ted Hope's wife or whatever. And then like
Vanessa Hope.
Yeah, something like, and then they like got the movie in front of her. She loved it, convinced Ted that it was good. And then all of a sudden, it's like got a Netflix deal for like insane amount of money.
I'm guessing it was probably an Amazon deal, but yes.
Yeah. Or, well, no, because then it went to like, I think it is on Netflix, but I think what happened was it went to like someone else. I don't remember the whole story. But anyways, someone made a phone call basically, and then it just got to the Netflix desk and they're like, oh yeah, we're buying this movie. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, here's a standard offer. What do you guys think? Oh, negotiate? Okay, here's a little bit more. And then they like suddenly get like $1 million for like a $700,000 or $500,000 movie. And it's just like, what? Like, how did that happen? Just because you happen to know the wife of the right person or whoever it is. Maybe it wasn't Ted Hope's wife. Maybe it was somebody else's wife. I don't know.
It was Ted Sarandis's wife.
Yes, that's who it was.
Probably because if you're saying Netflix and not Amazon.
Yes, exactly. That's who it was. So, Yeah, anyways, I'm telling stories out of school here, but, you know, like...
But why
like,
are you remembering it? You remember it because it's an outlier and it gives you hope and it's like... it's
no,
like
it doesn't give me hope. It doesn't give me hope at all because it's basically like you have to know the right person and grease the right wheels and like, you know, be in the right situation.
That's
and
life.
Like, you know,
yeah,
this person who's telling me this story is like, I have two Teslas and I, you know, he's already a rich person from other worlds. And so then it's like he's like... hobnobbing with the other rich people and then like doing stuff, you know. It's just like, okay, whatever, like, you know, when you're all got money, like, and then the money and connections, I guess that's what you need to have success in,
but that's
in any
the long
business,
game.
I suppose.
You and I are in the long game where we're growing our career every single film, which is what I tell all my clients is like, this is, you're not going to, you know, this is your first film. This is your second film. This is not going to be the thing. This is not the launch pad. There is no launch pad. Nothing catapults you. You grow incrementally every project. So like, that's the way to look at it. But I think it's, what you're, the situation you described me reminds me of, I love how I'm like, I'm a lady. Let me bring up lady references. There's the book, He's Just Not That Into You, which they made into a movie. But the like, the core message of that is like, you're not the exception. You always assume you're not the exception. Like, you can rationalize it a million ways. Like, it's going to be me. They're going to pick me. I'm going to be the one in a million. Never create a business strategy based off of being the outlier. And I would encourage filmmakers to look around, look to their left and look to their right. Do you know anyone who lives off of their income as from their films, from their independent films? Do you know anyone who lives off their incomes from their independent films?
Yeah. I mean, we probably only know like a few, but from our
from the podcast.
who aren't our friends, right? They're just people that we happen to interview.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, very few and far between. I guess it's just like... it's just sort of like interesting that like, you know, going back to Tom, who I'm, you know, we're putting on blast here, but it's like, you know, this guy wrote Dead Poets Society. He made, you know, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag studio movie. Like, you know, he's written tons of other stuff. Honey Shrunk the Kids, you know, whatever. And yeah, then he's got a movie that's like doing the rounds just like the other movies. And like, he probably has a better sales rep than, you know, most, but still it's like, that's what it is. And like, but the thing is like, you know, he's also happy with that because like he got paid to make his movie, you know, like I'm sure he got paid out of the budget, right? Like he didn't do it for free. It's not like he raised the money himself. Like somebody else raised the money, you know, for the project. He got a fee. They got a fee. Everyone got fees, you know, and he got to bring his art to life. And so like, I think for him, it's like, oh, it'll end up wherever it ends up and that's fine, you know, and then maybe I'll get to make another one. It's like just keep rolling down the road. So I've been thinking about that a lot lately. It's just that like, you know, it's what we always say, like, don't think about the outcome, right? Like, just think about like the journey. Yeah. And the thing you're making that you love, you know? So just going into my next movie, I'm just thinking about that a lot. Like, you know, either I'm going to get money, like a paycheck, you know, like, or some sort of fee and I love it, or I just love it and it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah.
And I think like the love it and doesn't matter, that's probably the way that the movie's going to actually get made more likely than getting the paycheck. Because getting a paycheck to direct anything is like, I mean, my God, how hard is that?
Well, I'm going to put forth option three, which is what I'm doing, which is making it how you want and making money from it, which is what we'll be doing. We'll be self-distributing. And we've been brainstorming models of like really fun, immersive exhibition. Like, I'll even just give you a taste of this. Like, I love the idea of breaking my film up into chapters and have it be like a high touch event of like maybe 30 people in a house, like a patron's house. And then we set up screens around the house. And then people do a choose your own adventure and they watch the film in whatever order they want to watch. And then there's a gathering area in the house, maybe in the lobby of the house or the living room of the house, where people talk about what they watched and what they should go see next. But to create an event out of it. And, you know, you can't do that if you have a distributor. You would be dissuaded from doing something like that if you had a sales rep, if they're a traditional sales rep. So it's like, what can you do to make the experience of watching a film unlike anything else someone has done before?
So that would be for one movie or multiple movies?
For one movie.
Okay. Well, so you have the same movie playing on a bunch of screens throughout a house, and then people just watch different screens.
No, you have different scenes playing throughout the house.
Oh,
and so it's all about choose your own adventure. How do you put the pieces together of the movie?
So you just play the scene on repeat on the screen, and then people just like a museum exhibition kind of?
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Yeah, I like it. And then it's like you have cocktails, you have food, you have actors who are part of it who come in and drop hints. You know, it's an immersive experience. Like the reason I'm trying to encourage everyone to push themselves into alternative exhibition or really make the most out of non-theatrical screenings is because what we're doing isn't working for us. You were talking right now, no one's making money, no one feels empowered, and we're exhausted, and we're not really, we have no creative control. So why not look at exhibition as a chance for creativity as well? And so that's what we're doing with the Patreon. And
how do you make money on that? Like, you just sell tickets to the exhibition and it's like more than, it's like 50 bucks?
Yeah, it's a high touch event. It could be whatever you charge. And it's like you do the math of what it costs to put it together. But people, I think, are very hungry for connection, for community, and for immersive experiences. I mean, look at Meow Wolf. The Meow Wolf is the perfect model for this. Do you know Meow Wolf? It's this like chain of immersive, it's like an immersive art museum in Las Vegas and in Santa Fe. And I think there's a third location, Denver. I mean, we're talking about this forever, so I'll cut this short. But it's the point is that people come in and they interact with the art. They're not passive. They're a part of the art experience. You're pulling knobs and you're going through doors and you're feeling and you're listening and you're using all your senses. And filmmaking doesn't have to be a passive experience, and it doesn't have to be 90 minutes to 120 or 150 minutes. It doesn't have to be exhausting, you know, $50 for parking and $50 for popcorn. It doesn't have to be that way. As independent filmmakers, we can create a different viewing experience for our audience. Right. And that's what I want to do.
Interesting. Fascinating. Well, I feel like there's a perfect plug for your Best Friends Forever Patreon page. Everyone should go check that out to find out more about this, because it's very, very cool. You're also doing very well with that. Congratulations. It's very exciting to see, you know, the buzz and the attention and the growth that you're bringing around that. So, you know, that's what I mean, making it happen. You know, you're just making your movie. You're doing it, you know. So it's very exciting to see.
Well, you too can make it happen at our Patreon campaign for this show. I can't do it. It's such a bad segue.
That was good.
But I do want to encourage everyone to support our show on Patreon, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. We want to wish happy, happy birthday to longtime listener and friend of the show, Earl Martin. Thank you so much, Earl. Earl has requested that we say, and we want to say it. He said, I started listening to the MMIH podcast many years ago. I went through the transition when Liz came on board, and although it was different, Ulrich, Liz team eventually grew on me, and I love you guys. It's been fun to watch you grow your brands, both individually and as a podcast. I'm rooting for you both in your filmmaking endeavors. I also appreciate the wealth of knowledge gained by listening to the show each week. A special treat was having my short Listen selected as part of the Get Shorty segment a while back. And I love the addition of the game segment, too. If anybody needs any encouragement or if you want to watch my other shorts, please visit my website at imalittlealien.com. Thanks again, Ulrich and Liz, for all that you do. That was really nice, Earl. Thank you for supporting
us.
Yeah. Also, everyone listening, don't forget to check out Jambox.io, which is a new royalty-free music and SFX company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. The composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay, Martin Scorsese, global brands like DJI. They offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is pretty awesome. But without any more delay, here's our chat with Mark Pellington.
Mark, give us the elevator pitch for Going All the Way.
The story or the new version or the...
Yeah, maybe both. Like, tell us what the movie is and then, like, you know, why the director's cut.
All right. Well, it was my first film. I'd had a career from starting in 1985, making music videos and working at MTV. Pretty successful through that period and music videos. And, you know, around 93. 94, I had started spending more time in California and had made some successful videos, and people were like, oh, you want time for you to do a movie? And it kind of was. I had done documentaries and poetry films and stuff, but hadn't really done a narrative feature. And Going All the Way was a book that I loved growing up, had read, you know, every year since I was 14 years old. And I thought it would make a good movie, and approached a guy at Propaganda Films and said, I've got this book. And he was a fan of mine. And we went to the original writer, Dan Wakefield, who had written the novel, and he'd written other screenplays for his movie Starting Over with Jill Clayburgh. And, you know, he had a successful career, and he was kind of a literary lion. And so he wrote the script, and a company called Lakeshore Films made it in 1996. And it was a 30-day shoot. I shot a 130-page script. I put everything from the book that I wanted in it. 6-day week, 16-hour days. Ooh. And we had future Academy Award winners behind the camera, costume design, Ben Affleck, Jeremy Davies, Rachel Weisz, Rose McGowan, Nick Offerman's first movie, Amy Locane. So, you know, it was a $3 million budget, 30 days, which you could get, you know, in 1996. You know, these guys were all unknowns. So Tom Rosenberg, the head of Lakeshore, you know, believed in the film and believed in me. And, you know, that in those days, $3 million was a decent indie budget. And he just said, you know, cast whoever you want as the kids, as long as you get two names for the mom. So Leslie Ann Warren and Jill Clayburgh were the names. So we made it. And, you know, it was like difficult and beautiful and exasperating and just every story you can imagine for a first movie. Yet it was really a performance-based piece. It's a coming-of-age story set in 1954 about two friends coming home from the Korean War, a nebbishy kind of nervous guy named Sonny Burns, played by Jeremy Davies, and an affable, you know, questioning BMOC, played Gunnar Kassman, played by Ben Affleck. So they meet on a train, and they kind of spend the summer going through their battles with, you know, pesky moms and girls and questioning life and, you know, the philosophical existential questions. And it kind of had this tone of a Midwestern Catcher in the Rye. It was funny, but it was mordant humor and kind of dramatic and really a story about friendship and two guys who really needed to leave home. I made a version of it, the version that came out that was sold at Sundance to Gramercy Pictures. It was a division of Polygram at the time.
Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
And it got, you know, good response at Sundance, and, you know, it sold. And at that point at Sundance, like, wow, you sold your film. That's really important. And Gramercy made some edits, and they made some suggestions and say, oh, shorten it here and shorten it there. And by that point, I'd been 3 years into the process. And I was kind of like, it wasn't a battle, but I remembered, like, the response was pretty good at Sundance. So, okay, great. You make these little changes. Cuts to, you know, the movie comes out, does okay, but you move on and, you know, you move on to your next movie. And with Lakeshore, we made Arlington Road and just kept going. But over the years, I kind of was like, well, Going All the Way disappeared. Polygram folded and the movie was never really got a brief DVD release, but then it kind of disappeared. It was never on cable, never on streaming, never had an afterlife like these movies do. You know, you can always check them out on cable late night or whatever, or you could go buy a Blu-ray and stuff like that. So cut to, you know, so it was a fond memory of my first movie that was like, yeah, it was like, it was mixed, you know, mixed results, I'd say. So during COVID, I was searching around in my office And I found an editor's assembly, a 3-hour tape, Betacam tape with the editor's assembly, which was the 3.5-hour assembly of all the scenes, every piece that we had shot. So what the editor's assembly is when the editor lays out everything you shot per script without kind of doing his cut. You know, I mean, he does his cut within scenes, but he doesn't leave anything out so you can kind of see and make these judgments. Well, I showed it to Leo Trombetta, who was the original editor. He wasn't doing anything at the time, and I put it on a drive and sent it to him, and he had an Avid in his house, and he put it in, and 6 weeks later, he goes, hey, I got something interesting to look at, and we looked at it, and we talked, and it was very much like we had been on the same page about what we missed and why we had lifted out an entire beard sequence and what we had done to get from 3.5 hours down to the first Sundance cut. And then what we did with the final thing. But boy, what we missed was this, this, and this. Now, having made 7 movies since then, 25 years of life experience, loss, love, more loss, the whole roller coaster, you learned a lot different thing about yourself as a filmmaker, as a man, as, you know, just mortality, everything. So you're wiser and you think a little smarter and a little more interesting. So Leo did a little of this, a little of that, and like, okay, well, what are we going to do with that? You know, maybe this was just an exercise and fun. But very soon after, I was doing some TV stuff for a company with some other Lakeshore properties, Mothman and Arlington Road. And I realized, I said, you know, you guys have a movie that Ben Affleck was in and all these stars that nobody ever saw. So you might be able to exploit this and make money from it by selling it. But I don't want to sell the old version, right? I don't want to sell the old the old 1997 version. I have a new version of it. And they're like, Concurrently, I had heard about Oscilloscope, which was a cool studio in New York that was restoring 90s movies. Tom Noonan's What Happened Was, John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus. Producer, a friend of mine doing Short Bus said, man, they do an amazing job. They put out a Blu-ray. They give you a theatrical. They can sell it to a streamer. I'm like, that's a dream, right? So I meet Dan Berger. I send him the film. I remember he goes, well, it's not really an auteur movie, but it's an interesting narrative behind the film itself. So he looked at it and we agreed, kind of came up with an agreement, and they came up with an agreement with Lakeshore, and we set off onto what was then a 9-month experience of finding the original film, going into boxes, the restoration itself, which is its own story. To make a long story short, we come up with a 2-hour and 5-minute version. We took out 25 minutes from the original film, put 55 minutes of new footage in, a new score by Pete Adams, new titles by Sergio Pinero, voiceover done by Leo. Leo had cut Todd Field's film, Little Children, which I loved. And I loved the kind of third person narration, which kind of fit the novel, the Going All the Way novel. So I had underlined the book over all these years many times. And I gave that to Leo, and Leo read the voiceover, and it's his voiceover, and it has that kind of, you know, detached, sardonic kind of observational tone. So again, this was all like, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe we're actually getting to do this, and that it's going to see the light of day with a documentary about the making of it, the new film, deleted scenes. So you go from a movie that, like, people had forgotten to now something that you can rediscover. And what it went from a tone that was leaning a little more unevenly on, let's say, on a horny kind of comedy drama to become a much more dramatic story. So a little less Porky's and a little more American Graffiti. Like, you're leaning into, once you take out the scenes that feel a little repetitive, you really define, like, wow, there really is a first act into a second act. There's really a third act now. And it's a much more even, tonally mature film that I'm like super, super, super grateful and proud to have. So I look at it last night and I'm like, yep, that's what I would make. Now, 20 years from now, I might make an even different version of it. But you can only make what you can make and create what you can create and reframe or re-edit based on your life experience at that point. I made the version back then of who I was then at, you know, 35 years old. And now, that was then, this is now.
So it wasn't like the movie you made when you first made it. It's not like that wasn't your director's cut. Like, that was your cut. It's just you changed as a person and now you made a new movie.
And that's why I call it, that's why we call it the director's edit. You know, it was like we wanted to call it redux, but that's been taken. It's like a revisitation. A revisitation of a novel. The novelization of a remix, really, because you're taking going back to the original elements. It's like director's cut to me always implies like, boy, the studio took away my movie and I didn't ever get to see it. It's not like this existed and somebody talked me out of it. Not at all. I mean, sure, that all the scenes existed in some larger 3.5 hour monster, you know, but like I wasn't mature enough or experienced enough to, you know, it was my first movie. I wasn't petulant. I wasn't like, get away from it. And I've had final cut on movies and I've had movies where I didn't have final cut. So that wasn't it. It's just like, what is the movie? Do you know, and studios and companies, well, I don't care if it's even an indie distributor, they're always going to make it shorter, right? But only later will be like, what is the right length for a movie? So I think in hindsight, you know, shorter isn't better. It's just what feels right. Now, maybe with more time, we would have explored this other thing. But when you're yanking at a 25-minute subplot of a beard, like that's just the way to get from 3 hours and 20 minutes down to manageable. You have to just lift certain things out as opposed, you don't just tighten every scene. No, but that's just, those are choices you make. So the good thing is you have all this footage to play with, but the downside is, you know, that's what you live with.
And how similar is the final re-edit to that first re-edit that your editor did with the Betacam footage? Is it like almost exactly the same, or did you guys, once you actually had access to the original film, did it change more from that point?
I mean, when he had the 3 hours assembly, he had all the scenes and he did a little cutting within scenes, but not much. I mean, if anything, it made it a little shorter, got out a little bit differently, or if we added voiceover to it, it truncated a little bit. But we didn't go back into scenes and completely recut whole scenes. It's once you decided, here's a scene, this was good, it's what we took out, right? And then said, okay, and put back in pretty quickly. Let's put the whole beard back in. Let's put the whole third act back in of them going to the quarry and him confessing at the fire to what happened. Like those two major chunks, when they went back in, then we looked at everything else that existed and it's like, wow, that seems very similar to this other one in the first cut, but it has a different kind of, you know, desperation to it with Amy Locaine, for example. So let's swap this for that. Where there's a scene with Leslie Ann Warren coming over in the original and Gunner's painting and she makes some anti-Semitic comment and Gunner's talking to Sonny about how he persuaded Marty to kind of be his girlfriend, right? This is before he grew the beard, the kind of midpoint thing. And you're like, all right, well, when you restore the beard thing, all of that's in there, right? All of that's in there. All of her biting commentary, all of his connection to her. So we lifted out the other scene. Now, the other scene was great and it looked good, but like, doesn't matter. Even if it had been in the first version of the house, that it's like that couch didn't belong in the new one, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it was in the other one. So that's the key, is like you're taking stuff out of that other version because the new version is meant to just be a little bit, you know, just a little bit more whole. And you're looking at the big, big, big picture. So, you know, they always say when you're editing, the hardest thing is like, when does the first act end? When do you like, when does the story really kick in? And that was the key in this, is we really got to, you know, as they say, they decide that there is more in life than a certain things, P. And like, you just get to that point cleanly, and it's clear that the movie is about these two guys going through this journey. And that's the movie. And I don't think that the first film necessarily told that story emotionally as cleanly as this one.
So I want to go back to something that you said earlier. Were you talking about the first version of Going All the Way, where you're like, oh, it was mixed results. The final result of the movie was mixed. But I mean, you know, that was a $3 million movie, you said. And then I know your next movie was a $30 million movie. So in a lot of ways, there's no way you can't look at that as like a success because it got you the $30 million movie. But can you talk about that? Like, what was it like going from making your first indie film for like, you know, whatever, $300 million and then, you know, having your budget increase by like tenfold on the next one?
Well, just because there's bigger budget just means there's more pressure, more pressure and more headache All I know is I made a lot of first time movie mistakes on Going All the Way. Like, I had never shot a basic narrative, screen direction, master over that film grammar. I shot tons of stuff and was very adept visually, but had never really done that. So once you do that, it's like your freshman year at college, right? Oh, I got it. So when I got the chance, I made a 45-minute film after Going All the Way with Jon Bon Jovi. It was a combination of music video and narrative and spoken word with Demi Moore and Kevin Bacon and Whoopi Goldberg. It was really a chance to make a second movie that nobody really saw. I mean, it was on VH1, a home video, but it was a great chance to almost make a second movie, work with stars, really continue to work my craft. Did a couple of episodes of TV for Homicide. So by the time Arlington Road came, I understood narrative more. And I also just worked my ass off on that film, prepping it. I had more days, which is good. So you're not like shooting 16-hour days, like trying to jam it in. Aaron Kruger's script was fucking bulletproof in terms of its structure. Like, it was really a great blueprint. Every time people say, wow, they really like that movie, I'm like, it was a great script. So I just really prepped it. Same DP, same production designer, you know, same team, but was just, and also like my instincts of it being darker tonally were probably closer to my, you know, I'm not sure that comedy or dramedy is my forte. I've made three of them and I like them, but I don't think it's my sweet spot. You know, like, I'm not going to be Hal Ashby. I'm not Hal Ashby. I never will be, but I like them because there's part of me as a human that likes that aspect of it. And I, you know, I actually think the new Going All the Way is probably the best movie of that genre that I've made, the new one.
Right.
You know, so, you know, the jump to a big one, I felt very comfortable working with actors. Like I said, you have 50 days instead of 30 days. So, you know, every day, though, you show up, do the work, and you weren't panicked. It wasn't like, fuck, let's get it all in, you know, and jam it in. It wasn't relaxed necessarily because the tone of the movie was very painful, you know. But again, I was super prepared, super buttoned up, trust the actors, and, you know, you just make that step.
So did you feel like a little sense of, you know, more time and more ease working with 50 days? Like, cause like, you know, you don't have to shoot as much a day if you're working with a, you know, with a 130 page script, 120 page script or whatever.
50 days is always better than 30 days. But it's again, you know, it's the days. It's the days, you know, with Going All the Way, it's like, lesson learned. Maybe 120 page script would have been a little smarter. But you never know those things. Like, if you can get it, you're always like, well, let me make those decisions in the edit room. And there's no formula. You know, there's no formula. They can shoot a, you know, Schrader told me, he goes, you know, write 90 page scripts because film is reductive, right? Like, you're going to have an assembly of 2 hours and 40 minutes and you're going to have to lose stuff. Watch a short, start with it shorter and let it expand or be more of the length that it should be. So stuff that I develop and write now is like nothing. Maybe the first vision is 135 pages, but it's like, that's not what I'm going to go shoot unless I get the juice and the ability for somebody to say, we love this. And you say, great, it's going to be a 2.5-hour film. Right? But I'm not at that point. I don't have that kind of, you know, cachet to get that unless I just, you know, do it on a smaller scale and say, you know, do it. I'm just going to just go make what I want to make at the length that it should be. But then does it get distribution? And, you know, that's a whole other ball of wax.
So let's go back. We really quickly glossed over your music video directing career that led to making your first feature. And I mean, you worked with some of the biggest names in music, like Alice in Chains. Your music video for Rooster is like super duper uber famous, which I don't know if people know, and it's great. I just watched it again the other day. Just, can you talk about like what that was like being like one of the top music video directors, like in the 80s, you know, and 90s, and like kind of what that career path was like? Like, were you like a fully paid director, like starting pretty early on, or did you have to work up until that was all you were doing? Like, how did it all kind of play out?
Well, I spent my 80s at MTV, and from 1983 when I was an intern until 1990 when I co-created a TV show called Buzz, which was a kind of a 30-minute global collage, super experimental, super ahead of its time, you know, kind of, you know, very cult show, and had done some videos on the weekends, like Information Society and some stuff that was hits within that world of MTV in 1987, 88. Now, to those viewers, I mean, that was fucking a long time ago. MTV was an incredibly powerful force from 81, but really its heyday from 84 to really 95, maybe the late 90s, its impact on the music business and how it affected music and the sales of music. Again, remembering pre-Napster, you know, we're talking before the rise of DVDs, before music was free, right? So music videos were highly, highly respected. I don't think the forum is as respected now as it used to be because it was new and it was like really, really impactful. And the bands and the trust that bands gave you was immense, and the budgets were good, and you could really, like, with one video break a band, and you were given a lot of freedom, like Rooster. And I mean, now you get treatments and it's like, here's the four videos we want it to be like, and the budgets are like one fifth of what they used to be. Back then it was like there was respect and it's like, we want you to do this. Now I guess it's the same as the movie business. If doing Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and stuff like that was the equivalent of Oscar winner, sure, then you get that freedom, right? Damien Chazelle gets to make Babylon now because he won Oscars, right? So at that point, music videos were, I love music. I love subconscious storytelling. I love imagery. I love that emotion. I think it's my favorite form. Even the last videos in the last 5 years I've made, I love. So I've made like 120 of them from starting in 85 to now. The business has changed, but I love the artist. I love working with music and imagery and abstraction and whatever it is. And they were great. And you get to work with people like John Schwartzman, famous DP, shot Alice in Chains. You know, like great, great DPs over the years, different people, and great freedom where they're like, here's the song, do your thing. There's no focus groups. There's no people hanging on the set. There's no 20 people at Video Village. It's like really you and the artist really collaborate on the idea. So the last couple I did like that, Imagine Dragons and Demi Lovato in 2018. And then 2019, I made a film for Quibi, and then COVID hit and everything has kind of turned upside down since COVID. That business, all businesses. So I'm like, I just want to make movies and make small stuff. I don't care what the budget is, but I just want to keep making stuff.
Can you talk a little bit about like what it takes to win the artist's like trust when it comes to making a music video? I mean, I'm sure with your name and your track record, like Demi Lovato and Imagine Dragons, they must be like, oh yeah, this guy's the guy. Like he's done hundreds of music videos for like the biggest names in the business. Like they probably inherently trust you. But I mean, when you first got started, like how do you convince Alice in Chains to go along with your idea for, you know, a music video?
Well, it's changed. It's changed. And also the music business has changed. Rock music is dead, right? So like, just go look at like the music videos. Like there's directors now that speak more of the language of like hip hop and rap and pop now, and Lizzo and Taylor Swift and Billie Eilish and stuff like that. Like that's not my forte. I mean, I think I could direct anything, but like, it changes, right? It changes the same way when I was coming up that there was other directors who had been like big for the hair bands and Guns N' Roses, right? So it changes. But in answer to your question about like, say, Alice in Chains, they had seen Jeremy, and Jerry Cantrell had a really deep father story that he wanted to tell. I had made a documentary about my dad. So we bonded on the idea of fathers and memory and pain. And I just remember they said, here's the song. And I heard it and I was like, so epic. And I knew what it was about. And I had one conversation with Jerry and, you know, kind of who his dad was and what he wanted to do. And then I'm like, got it. And I just, right. Here you go. And 95 times out of 100, they trust me and I go and I do it. Occasionally, a Nine Inch Nails thing later, a little bit of a disagreement in the edit. And you understand it's their song, their vision, and you do the best you can. But at the end of the day, if Trent wants it a different way, then that's his vibe. Same way if I'm a filmmaker, I say, hey, can you do some songs for me for a movie? And I'm like, yeah, they don't quite work. You know, so all you want is that respect. To be like, hey, it didn't work, so we're going to try this. But across throughout time, that's why it's like, if you just connect with the artist and say, what is it you want to make? I'm your interpreter. And then I could personalize and really put my own spin on it. Those are the best. Because if you're going to go do something, it's like, well, we want it to be like this, this, and this thing. And we want it to look like this. And we want, here's the idea. Not that, like Demi Lovato, the two videos I did for her, she really had the idea what she wanted to do. I was like, great. And she trusted me. But the other ones, if you're going to, it's like, then just do a commercial, right? I'll just go do a commercial and sell a sneaker or a candy bar or an Alzheimer's drug, because they should just get somebody else to do it in video. So I unfortunately have tended to be kind of picky and elitist about what I'll do. And as it changed, it's like, okay, you know, like I don't need to prove myself in that medium, you know, but because like it's just, there's a certain way I work that I know where I do my best work, and that comes from the trust. So if the trust isn't there and you're competing, and fine, you can compete against people, you can write treatments and may the best filmmaker win with the treatment. That's fine. That's always what you're doing in the business. But you don't want to jump through too many hoops, you know, when the budget's smaller and you love the song. But like to Cage the Elephant or Linkin Park or this run of videos in the like 2016 were great. But again, I go show Linkin Park. I meet him at Guitar Center on my phone. I say, here, I think it should look like this. I had written a 3-page kind of treatment. That was it. They're experienced guys. They knew, they trusted me. They knew it was going to be of a certain quality.
Yeah.
You know, so that's also the front of your, like your reps and the people that position you out there. They just have to be like, look, here it is. Here's the body of work. What do you think?
Yeah.
But you know, that was then and this is now. That's fine.
So I noticed, you know, and you mentioned that Going All the Way premiered at Sundance, and you had a couple, quite a few of your films have premiered at Sundance. I think one year you even had two films at Sundance. So can you talk a little bit about like your relationship with Sundance and how instrumental that film festival has been in your career, if at all?
Very much so. I remember I was really bummed that the last movie, Nostalgia, in 2018 didn't get in there. Again, I was looking at some photos and talking to Neil LaBute recently, because we both had our first movies there in 97. You know, it's changed. The indie film business has changed. In 97, it was like just taking off, right? So you're talking like, wow, that's where indie movies were like, wow, really, there was a business of it. There was a huge thing. 2007 with Henry Poole Is Here and U2 3D still thriving. Even 2011 with I Melt With You. I mean, we got creamed at Sundance, but super proud of that movie still. You know, I think it just was a little bit like, we're just going for it, right? And but then it's changed, you know, it's just harder and harder to get in festivals, the culture of ratings and likes and algorithms that, you know, and then the cultural changes, and Sundance now is not what Sundance was in 97. Maybe they think spiritually, maybe at the core, but like there was no like, you know, gifting suites. I saw the change and it's kind of the change of the, you know, the quantifying culture taking over in America, right? I mean, globally too, but like, it's about numbers and it's about numbers and it's about money and it's about money and it's about, you know, just it's a different world. It's not, and that's life, right? It just, it moves on, it emerges, it changes. But, you know, storytelling, audience connection is audience connection. So every year Sundance should be that place where, wow, you really see that thing that speaks to you or moves you regardless of genre. And I think it still is, you know, I mean, I think it still is the most desired preeminent launching pad for movies. But now is it content or, you know, I don't know. It changes, right?
Yeah, crazy. Let's talk a little bit about your Quibi movie, Survive. So can you talk about how you got involved in that in the first place? Like, did the Quibi people approach you? Like, did you know it was going to always be just this 8-minute installment thing from the beginning? And then obviously when everything happened with Quibi happened, like, I'd love to hear about how you got it put back into a feature, you know, in the end.
Sure. Well, look, it's like when somebody gets falls in love and they get married, they don't have any idea that 2 years later, like, oh my God, the person becomes psycho and they're going to get, like, no one knows. You're driving and then there's a car accident, right? So in the late 2018, 2019, this app was going to be launched called Quibi that everybody in the world wanted to be in business with them. And they were giving a lot of money and a lot of opportunities and creative freedom and ownership to filmmakers to make pieces, to make series. And okay, you're going to make your movie, but as long as you tell it in 8 to 10 minute chapters, people are going to watch their shows on their phones. And I'm like, well, don't people already do that? Like Netflix and, you know, people watch stuff on phones, but oh, we're going to do it in short bits so people on the go can watch it. And I was always like, all right, well, I don't know if that's necessary. That might be right for certain kinds of movies, maybe serialized or mysteries or something like that for 8 minute pieces. But, you know, I was just approached. It was kind of like a job. I was approached with this.
Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
This adaptation of this YA book called Survive, and I read the script and I really liked it. And I read the script without any like episode breaks. It was just, I read the script. And so when they showed me the thing with it, you realize like every 10 pages, which is not a bad thing to happen in screenwriting, especially a action or suspense thing, something should happen every 10 pages, right? And you think about, wow, that's actually interesting if you just can watch it like that. And I always thought, well, you can always watch it on your TV or watch it on your computer. But the fact that they were like, no, it's only on your phone, I was like, well, that's pretty arrogant, but you know, a lot of people were jumping on, right? So the advice was go do a Quibi thing. And I liked, but more importantly, again, I liked the story. And I went, and it was a job, and I went for it, and I got it. And I wanted to go shoot in Europe, and I liked it. And so we cast Sophie Turner, who I really liked. Yeah. Corey Hawkins, who was great. And I had a great time making it. And we're finishing it, and Jeffrey Katzenberg loved it. Like, it was like, wow, you're excited. And then COVID hit and just everything. And it was like the wrong idea at the right time or the right idea at the wrong time, whatever. But the response to it was just like, so they didn't, you make a movie normally and like you get to see it or make a piece and it's out there and people digest it, right? And review it. Well, what they did was the equivalent of, I described it as like there's a buffet, right? And here's the steak, and here's the prime rib, and here's the chicken, and here's the beets, and here's the salad dressing, and here's the strawberry shortcake. Because they had docs, they had comedy shows, they had all these shows, right? So instead of delineating, they just dumped everything on a table for reviewers to look at. So what they were reviewing was the app, right? They're reviewing the navigation of the app and the horizontal versus vertical. And so the shows themselves were like, yeah, yeah, well, we like that, and that's thumbs up, and you know, we only saw 2 episodes. I'm like, that's 16 minutes. How do you review a film? And here, I'm just going to, you know, you write an article. I'm only going to read your first 150 words, right? And you're like, right there. So the fact that it was kind of the chopped up response to it, I don't think maybe I read a couple of reviews of somebody had watched the whole series and had watched the whole, all the episodes together as a piece. And the response was really good. I'm like, well, but before you knew it was like people were coming out and just destroying the app. It became kind of the joke. It became the thing. You're like, wow, that's a real bummer. Now, I've done pilots before that never saw the light of the day. And at least they're just like, they disappear. It's like a bad date, right? Or a bad meal you make. You're like, see ya. But this was out there. And again, you kind of stand by the work. And before we were done, though, we had strung together all the pieces for a feature. We knew we wanted to make a feature version at some point. So we pieced all the stuff together. And the good thing about making all those 8 to 9 minute things work on their own, when we watched it all together, it moved really well. It wasn't like, oh boy, this is like 3 hour movie that you got to compress. It was already done. If anything, we opened it up, put a couple scenes back in. We opened up a lot of the aerials, which are beautiful mountain things. So a 3 second shot on your phone becomes a 6 second shot on a big screen, you know, stuff where like you're allowed to let the experience of aerial, you know, mostly aerials or certain things, drone shots. We quickly got that, redid some score, and we had that done. And the goal was like, great, let's sell it to a streamer or whatever the studio that was in control of it. But there got to be a lot of problems with Quibi. Blamed out the rights to the film, who had them, and then it became one of those like debacles of, you know. So I think some, they've sold it around the world, some distributor here, not even a major one, shockingly, because even though Sophie Turner's character has mental health issues, they're like, oh, does this trigger people about suicide? So it's going to come out at some point on some like freestyle releasing, but like I look at freestyle releasings movies, I'm like, boy, that's pretty. It makes Gravitas Ventures look like A24, you know what I mean?
I almost went with freestyle for my first film. I didn't, but just...
Well, you know what I mean? I mean, your MD is like, it's like, I was like, come on, these are two, it's a good piece. I would be the first one to be like, wow, I really fucked up. It's, yeah. I don't know why they, I can never understand the sales strategy. And I think it's just the people that hired me, a great producer named Cary Grant, he's the one that hired me. And he had a lot of bumps with Gunpowder and Sky, the studio. Oh, wow. And I think there was different philosophies about what was going to happen with this thing. And when you've got just tons of stuff and, oh, it's content, let's sell it off, it becomes a widget. You know, it just becomes when the filmmaker loses the ability to go out and get their film and really present it to the world, it's, you know, it just becomes like a garage sale. And I like the people, I like Van, and I like, personally, I like the people at Gunpowder, but I was very disappointed in what the end result of the film is in terms of how it's going to be seen.
So you've kind of done it all. You've done music videos, you've done documentary, you've done television, you've done many features, you've done a Quibi show, you've done everything. What advice do you have to like young filmmakers who are trying to get their first, second, or third movies off the ground? Like what in this day and age in the film business can we be doing to like help get our movies funded and you know, greenlit?
Well, I'm in the same boat as you. I have 10 movies that I'd like to make. And if somebody gave me $50 million, I could make 8 of them.
Wow.
$3 million movies, a few that are like 4 to 5. Maybe the biggest budget one I would need is like 15, right? And you got to compress the budget. You know, for me, I'm like, design it. And now again, ask me in 5 years if this worked. You know, nostalgia I made, I paid for it myself with my brother. Broke even. Wow. But like,
wow.
They 17 days, good roles for actors, Alex Ross Perry's script, get a good casting director. Don't try and think you can cast it yourself unless you know agents. Harder and harder now to get actors attached to your script. You know, it used to be you could get 2 actors attached and then go raise the financing from that. That model's harder and harder and harder, right?
Yeah.
I've never made a studio movie. Every studio movie I've ever been attached to never got made. They were all independent studios or financiers. Lower your budget, but don't lower your vision, but just know what you're going. So if you say, I need this, how many days do you need? I always do a schedule with an AD, and I always do a budget. And I say, this is what I need. I need 17 days and I need 1.8 million. But if I do it in this state, we can get it down to we need 1.2, right? Wow. Just because I know the control that you can get from a smaller thing. And you could just say, I'm making the movie. There's no better power than saying we're making the movie, not like we want to make, or the financier fucked me over, or these producers were lazy or whatever. So I just like, the more I can produce, the more I can connect to people who like my work and say, here it is. But Sean, you're going to wait. You wait 2 years, just keep going through to get the actor attached because it's a $10 million thriller. And like, okay, well, let's get this actress before she joins the VIP club and is inaccessible and busy for 2 years. They're kind of trying to keep an eye on talent. But if you've got a script and you say, yeah, it's a drama or whatever, and you want to make it, well, who do you know? Never burn any bridges, right? Never burn bridges. And just always be respectful, because if somebody gives you money, $5,000 for a music video or $50 million for a movie, there's expectations when you're taking somebody else's money. So be on the same page. If you can know that, like, doing a horror movie or doing a thriller has more genre things, those are easier to sell or get out in the world than straight dramas, but don't give up on straight dramas. And if you believe in it, they're your children. They're your things. I've got scripts I've been pushing for 10 years. Sometimes you got to know, take it off the stove, put it away, right? Because maybe the culture's not right for it. You reanimate it. And it's always your baby. You always love it. It's hard sometimes to be like, wow, I'm never going to make that, am I? I don't really give up on these things. You know, you don't give up on your dreams. And all it takes is one actor or one financier to say yes and be like, I'm making it.
So we only have 2 minutes left. So I'm going to do a very, very fast version of our final questions. So first question is, what's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
The best filmmaking advice?
Yeah.
Shoot a master at double speed. This is like in a drama. Shoot a master at double speed, so when you cut to the wide master, that you're not like slow. Don't be best friends with your actors. Be a benevolent like parent. Don't waste your time on like big wide shots that you're barely going to use. The more you can prepare, and you know, I don't storyboard, but I write a lot of shot lists down, and find people that believe in you, that can support the way that you work rather than the way that they work, you know, because everybody's process is different, and some people move and some people communicate differently. So I surround myself with people that are kind of chill, because I tend to be passionate madman, but you know, it changes over time. And you know, you got to be yourself, you got to, because it's hard work, but you got, and if you love it, you're like, fuck, I love what I'm doing. I love shooting today. Did it work? And like at the end of the day, also don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Early on, it's like, oh, what's this? And over-explain to an actor, like, I don't know. What do you think? Let's see. Let's just try it. Like, kind of be fearless. Like, who cares? Just try it. There's nothing wrong. There's no wrong, right? All it is choices. It's like, oh, the actor did it that way. Okay, great. And you might say to yourself, I don't have to use it. Usually actor's big blustery scene is never the best one. Usually the next one. You know, I've learned that 5 different movies. Like, oh, the big Tim Robbins, the big, I'm like, no, great. And you're like, got it out of your system? Okay. Because the next one is tempered with the energy of like, yes. And it's usually then like, once that's out, it's still in the body. It's still in the energy, but it's not leaning into it. It's not trying so hard, you know?
Wow. Amazing. And then last question, is making movies hard?
I think getting movies made, getting them greenlit is hard. I don't think making them is hard. I think making them is fun. It's hard work, but I think making them is incredible gift that we have. And post, somebody said one time, what are your favorite parts of making a movie, right? Like, what are the favorite times? And I say, the minute you get the green light and you know you're making it, right? Then usually like one of the early days of shooting or near the end, when it's like, when it's just coming together and you do a scene or you do a shot or you do something, it's like, fuck, that's like where your brain, something you saw in your head, comes to life in a beautiful alchemy. Also then, usually when you're watching it, mixing it the last time, which is the last time to put any touches on it, those are my 3 favorite times.
Amazing. All right, where should people go if they want to watch Going All the Way, the director's edit? Is it, when is it going to be out? And what should people do if they want to follow your work?
Well, if they want to follow my work, my website, markpellington.com, has everything, and rarities and stuff from early MTV stuff and experimental stuff and stuff that nobody's ever seen, and every article and every piece of press and everything I've made ever is on there. The full-length movies aren't on there. I'm excited about a movie that's coming out in January, a dance film I made called The Severing, that's super cool, that Kino Lorber is going to help me get out in the world. Going All the Way, it's playing the next couple nights, tonight at Braindead Studios on Fairfax. Next week on the 17th, it's playing at the Lemley. got some dates coming up. If you go to the Oscilloscope website, they'll be able to tell you. And then it's opening in New York on December 16th at the Quad.
Awesome.
And in different cities. I don't know exactly the different cities it's coming to. I think 10 cities.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
Ulrich, what's something that's not in the interview that you remember about your chat with Mark Pellington?
Not in the interview. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's okay with me saying this, but like at the end, or maybe this is actually in the interview. I can't remember, but he basically was just saying that, like, you know, he's in the same boat as the rest of us. Like, it's hard for him to make a movie, you know, like, and this guy's made like, you know, whatever it is, 6 or 7 features and, you know, millions of music videos for like some of the biggest names in music from like the early days in the 90s all the way to like Imagine Dragons and Demi Lovato and like famous people who we all know, you know? And so it's like to have him say, yeah, like, you know, I'm in the same boat. I'm just hustling, trying to get my movies made. It's just like, okay, this is the future that I want, is to be doing the same thing I'm doing now, but without a day job. He doesn't have a day job like I do, which is pretty nice, obviously. But no, I mean, he was really cool. I feel like Mark like kind of had, like, it was just like talking to any other filmmaker that I've met or, you know, chatted with. Like, he was really down to earth, a really lovely guy. And just, you know, it was really interesting hearing, I loved like his whole philosophy about recutting his movie and the way it really made me question, like, what am I going to think of myself in 20 years from now? Like, what am I going to think of my work as a filmmaker? Like, how am I going to view back what I've done, or where will I be when I'm in his shoes looking back at my first feature in 25 years, you know? So it's a very interesting experience. It kind of made me think about like how long life is, and that, like, you know, I feel like this pressure to like make movies and go fast and, you know, follow up the first movie with the second movie. And it's just like, no rush. I could wait 10 years and it would be fine. You know, like, I just don't worry about it too much, because I look at guys like Mark Pellington or even Tom, you know, from our interview last week, and just like, these guys are like in their 50s, 60s and they're still swinging, still trucking, making their movies. They probably all have many more movies left in them. And it's just like, yeah, man, you know, no stress. Just enjoy life and focus on the things that matter most. I think he said something to that effect too. It's just like the things that matter, you know, like, you know, spending the time with, I don't know, maybe I'm making this up. I think what it made me think about was just like being with family and like, you know, making sure that you're not neglecting that for what you think is the most important, like, move in your career. But it's like, well, there'll be others, you know, don't worry. You know, so that's kind of what I took away, that probably isn't even in the interview at all, but just like my like emotional reaction to our conversation.
Oh, it's all good. Those are all good messages to receive.
All right. Well, I think without further ado, it's time to play the game. Here, I've got the question.
I'm taking notes. I got my pen. I got my paper.
I know. I love it. I was just going to say, you know, like, and Liz always grabs her notes and is like ready for action. All right. So the game, people, if you don't know what this is your first time listening, it's basically a challenge that we take on every week where we get a question either created by a listener or by our producer, Eric Toms. Basically, it's like a indie filmmaker conundrum. Like, you're making a movie. This shit happens. How do you solve it? Like, how do you solve this crazy problem that, you know, you did not expect in your movie? So Liz has not heard this yet. I haven't even really read it yet. I just kind of saw that it was there. I like to go into these really fresh too, just because I think it's fun to like discover the question while I'm reading it. So this one is from listener Colin Stryker again, who is the game regular now. I think this is his third question that he's brought to us, which is really fun. I encourage more listeners to write us questions if you want. Zoe
Eisenberg sent one.
She wrote one too, which was really fun. So yeah, get in the game, people. Get in the game.
Uh-huh.
by asking us a question or sending it to Eric. You don't even have to send it to Liz and I. Just send it directly to Eric.
Don't send it to us. Please don't send it to us.
Or email the podcast email, and then Eric will respond, and then we'll get it going. Anyways, Without any more delay, here is the question. You are 5 weeks through 6 weeks of principal photography for a taut, complex thriller with a crazy twist ending. It has been a very difficult shoot, and you and your crew are exhausted, but dedicated to seeing it through. Unfortunately, you are behind schedule, so you need to make up ground in the last week of production. But it has just occurred to you that a scene you shot early on creates a humongous plot hole. If people think of the plot hole, the crazy twist ending simply won't work. Still, no one on your crew has thought of it, but that may be because everyone, including yourself, is too close to the material. Audiences may not be so forgiving. You've thought of a way to fill the plot hole, but it requires going back and reshooting that earlier scene. A long day's worth of work. Do you A. ignore the plot hole and pray no one thinks of it? B. insist on going back to reshoot, possibly invoking the ire of your crew and contributing even ire of your crew and contributing even further to your delay? C. put it to a vote among your crew, or D. other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Well, I feel like the answer is easy, and so now I'm questioning whether it's the right answer. But if you already shot the scene and there's a plot hole, I'm assuming there's a way you can reshoot a fragment of the scene and not the whole scene, but just like maybe a few close-ups that address this plot hole element. It's vague, right? We don't know what the plot hole is. We don't know how complex it is, but I don't know why you would have to reshoot the entire scene. You must be able to use the wides from the original shoot unless there's something I don't know about that has to do with this plot hole. So for me, it sounds like a combination of ADR and pickups for that scene would make the most amount of sense in that last week of the shoot. And then of course he said that takes one day, but maybe it takes less than a day if you're just doing a few shots and then working with your team to figure out what the rest of the week entails in order to catch up. But I would not in any way reach out to the entire crew and ask them to vote on this. That seems like a real bad idea. But it would be having a conversation with your producers, your AD, and probably your DP, you know, maybe some heads of department, but really I defer to probably my DP, AD, and producer. That always seems to be kind of a triumvirate. And ask them what is possible with the time we have left in order to what we can accomplish in the time left. But what would you do?
Yeah, I think it's funny that you're not going to the whole crew, because I feel like you know you're a very collaborative person. You're into this whole idea of like, you know, bringing the crew and we're making this movie together. So I kind of expected you to want to talk to your crew.
Not when you're like tired. I mean, he kept saying like you're tired. Your crew's gonna get angry, and like you're so close. You're so close to being done.
Yeah. Well, so I have like usually my people on a film set that I have like trust with creative decisions. It's usually, well, I guess on my feature, that's like the best example. It was like, you know, my producer, my AD, and my DP. And then actually sometimes the production designer, because the production designer is a filmmaker also, and he's got like this really good
sense on the show for story. I remember.
Yeah. Rob. Yeah, he's like this guy who, like, whenever I send him the script for a movie, he always has tons of creative notes, not just art director's notes. It's always like this creative stuff. And so like he's somebody that I always like kind of bring into these things to like kind of check me if I'm thinking crazy, because like I think that's what happens when you're making a movie. You start to think crazy and then you start to like invent all these things that are wrong with your movie. Like, oh, is this a problem? Is this a problem? Is that a problem? So like I feel like just thinking that you have a plot hole from an earlier scene like could very well just be in your brain and not be real. So like I think it's really important to do what you said too, is just like bring your brain trust together. Like people who know the movie well, there's actually a friend of mine who reads all my stuff who like doesn't necessarily work on my movies, but like he's very familiar with them. So it's like, okay, I'll bring that person in and like ask them, like, what do you think of this? Is this a problem or am I crazy? And then have that conversation. And then I think you're right. I think like you don't necessarily need to pull the whole day on this. Like, you know, having re-edited movies and like taken a whole plot, you did this too, like taken whole plots out, replaced scenes, changed complete meanings of scenes from one thing to another thing with VO and just re-editing. Like, you could do it all in post, probably, but like, it's kind of a, if you catch something like that while you're still on set and you're still shooting, it's kind of like this gift where you're like, oh, we have resources. We can come up with a creative solution to this problem that's not gonna kill us, and then we can squeeze in that'll work and solve the problem, right? So I think it's like one of those wonderful like puzzle piece times where you, it's time for you and your brain trust to like think about how to rework this problem, or if there is even a problem in the first place. So yeah, definitely wouldn't ignore it. Don't ignore your gut. Never ignore the little thing in your head that's like pecking at you, because that's like that's gonna bite you in the butt. Even if no one else notices, you'll hate yourself later for ignoring yourself, you know? But yeah, I definitely don't think you need to go back and reshoot the whole day. Like, that's always a better way than like, you know, burning a whole day or redoing something completely. Like, you never have to redo something completely. There's always ways to make things work. So yeah.
Well, I think what Colin isn't saying, you know, and very often this isn't included in the game question, is this the labor of love, writer, director, film, or is this a 1 year for hire? And I think both of us are the type of artists where we're not going to just like do a schlocky job and just hope the audience doesn't notice. But if there's a world where you're brought on, you've already had a bunch of creative conflicts with the material, you're being paid, but you're being exploited. You know, there is a world where I can see someone answer the question of, I hope the audience doesn't notice. I'm exhausted. I'm not being treated well. And no one cares about what I say anything anyway. But I think you and I wouldn't probably be in that situation, right? Because we'll probably be saying yes to projects that want us there and want our creative input. And then our job as a director is to make it as good as possible and to make the experience as an audience member as enjoyable as possible. But I could see someone answering one of those options. Like, I hope they don't notice.
Yeah. I kind of feel like if you were a director for hire, you probably would have already caught this and you probably would have already brought it up to the producer or the writer or whoever is the decision maker. And they probably would have already told you to not worry about it. Right. So I feel like you probably already had this conversation at some point. But yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, yeah. Is there a world where I would ignore it? I don't know. Probably not. I think everything, because like when you're you work so hard on something, even if you're getting paid, if it's just a job, it's not your work. You didn't originate it. It's still going to be attached to your name. Like, you still want to be proud of it, you know, like, and it's still going to be the thing that determines what your next job is, or if you get a next job, or if you have to be the originator of your next job, you know? So anyways, very, very interesting. Good question, Colin. I like it. Fun stuff. And I feel like you said that it was easy, but your solution was not so cut and dry.
That's true.
which I thought was cool.
That's true.
And it's like you thought it was like, oh, that's easy. Like, here's the complicated way I'll figure this out. It's like, oh, I love seeing the minds of directors unfurl before us. It's very cool. But, you know, if you want to be like Colin and send us wonderful questions, you can do that by reaching out to us at podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. You can also just ask us questions, suggest topics, suggest guests, whatever. We're open. You can also leave us a review on iTunes, which would be fantastic. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. We are finally caught up on YouTube. All Woo-hoo! Our episodes from the last couple months are on there, which I just bit the bullet and did one day, a lot of data entry, but it was great. You should also make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and lots of other great stuff. So go over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks so much to Mark Pellington for coming on the show and for the really, really awesome conversation. Thanks to Sarah Sampson from Consumer One PR for setting this up. And she really like said so many nice things about us to Mark right before we started. She's like, listen, Ulrich, they're like one of our like favorite interviewers. They asked us the best questions. Oh, it's so much great. Oh, I'm so glad that you were able to get this for you. And I was like, oh, Sarah, oh my God.
That's so
You're the greatest. Love you. So thanks, Sarah. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freiermuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being amazing. Thanks to you all for listening. And we'll talk to you next week.
Plus has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.